He was 46. Hard to believe it was 61 years ago. In 2013, for the 50th anniversary of JFK's assassination, attorney Danny Sheehan taught an intensive 20-session class at UC Santa Cruz. It's now on YouTube. Then as now, unanswered questions remain. Rose and Joseph Kennedy Sr. were parents of 9 children. Joe Sr. was President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's ambassador to the United Kingdom. He wanted his firstborn, Joe Jr., to become president. Lieutenant Joe Jr. was killed in World War II and posthumously awarded the Navy Cross. Lieutenant Junior Grade John F. Kennedy almost lost his life when he commanded a Navy PT boat. It was sunk in the Solomon Islands by a Japanese destroyer. Kennedy rescued his men, saving them from drowning. This episode was made into a movie, PT-109. John assumed the political mantle and began his long quest to the presidency. He won the race for senator from Massachusetts, but didn't become the Democratic vice presidential candidate in 1956. That same year, Kennedy won a Pulitzer Prize for his nonfiction book, Profiles in Courage. JFK was narrowly elected president in 1961. On November 22, 1963, President Kennedy's Lincoln, without a protective bubble top, slowly made the turn onto Elm Street in Dallas, Texas. As his motorcade passed the Texas School Book Depository, the president waved to the crowd. Ukrainian-born clothing manufacturer Abraham Zapruder captured Kennedy's assassination on his handheld 8mm camera. I asked a friend how she had heard JFK was assassinated. It was during her English class at Muir High School in Pasadena. A monitor returned to the class with the report. The teacher told the young woman not to joke about such things. At lunch, it was so quiet you could hear a pin drop. The world watched Walter Cronkite confirm Kennedy was dead. Songwriter Dion DiMucci remembered JFK. He freed a lot of people, but it seems the good, they die young. I just looked around, and he's gone. That's another story. Have you ever been interested in looking back 61 years?
On KPFK, you hear more than a soundbite. That's education. That's our mission.
This is John Crumshaw for KPFK with a special Politics or Pedagogy Education Report. Please make your contribution online at kpfk.org.
This is KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Good afternoon and welcome to Middle East in Focus. I'm Negwa Ibrahim. The U.S. Senate on Wednesday greenlit the Pentagon's request to send $20 billion in new different offensive weapons to Israel after the U.S. Senate had rejected a legislative effort that actually would have blocked this arms sales to Israel, which was introduced by Senator Bernie Sanders, known as the Joint Resolutions of Disapproval, which would have blocked specifically this sales of 6 different kinds of weapons to Israel that was, as I mentioned, worth a total of $20 billion. Now, this is the first time Congress voted on legislation blocking arms sales to Israel. And actually, 18 senators did back the joint resolution of disapproval. On Tuesday, Senator Sanders held a press conference stating, quote, "All of this death and destruction is being supported by U.S. taxpayers. The U.S. has provided in recent times over $18 billion in military aid to Israel and delivered more than 50,000 tons of armaments and military equipment. In other words, as Americans, we are complicit," end quote. Since last October, Israel has been able to wage a genocidal war on Gaza while receiving little more than a light slap on the wrist. President Joe Biden and his administration have claimed to be working tirelessly toward a ceasefire, all while continuing to supply Israel with the billions of dollars in weapons it needs to prolong its assault and genocide. The United Nations and Human Rights Watch are among those who have resoundingly documented the rampant violations of human rights that Israel has committed in the last year alone. This includes the systematic destruction of Gaza's healthcare system through relentless and deliberate attacks on medical personnel and facilities, the torture and rape of Palestinians detained in Israeli military camps, deliberate home demolitions, the bombing of safe zones and evacuation corridors, and the forced displacement of 90% of Gaza's population. The latest evidence that the country is systematically and deliberately blocking humanitarian aid in Gaza arrives months after the International Court of Justice already found it plausible that Israel's committing acts of genocide. Citing the humanitarian crisis, hundreds of human rights organizations around the world have called for the U.S. to stop the weapons transfers. But the State Department still claims it doesn't see a problem. This is not only a moral failing, but also a violation of the law. The Foreign Assistance Act and the Leahy Law dictate that the U.S. cannot send weapons to governments committing human rights violations. But time and time again, the U.S. has failed to abide by its own legal code. Meanwhile, Israeli forces have continued to pound Gaza and have stepped up attacks on Lebanon. And now, in the wake of former President Donald Trump's re-election, Israel's far-right minister of finance suggested the country would look to annex the occupied West Bank in 2025. With Trump's re-election, various Israeli officials hailed Trump's victory, and it's no wonder. As Mitchell Plitnick writes, quote, Trump's most recent nominees reflect an extreme approach to foreign policy, especially in the Middle East. For all of Trump's talk on the campaign trail about being the anti-war candidate, he wasted no time in shedding that illusion, end quote. So with us today to talk about Trump's most recent nominees and what U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East will look like under a second Trump administration is our guest, Mitchell Plitnick, a political analyst and writer. He is president of Rethinking Foreign Policy and is co-author with Mark Lamont Hill of Except for Palestine, The Limits of Progressive Politics. Mitchell writes the Cutting Through newsletter at Substack and publishes a weekly column at MondoWeiss.net. Mitchell's previous positions include vice president at the Foundation for Middle East Peace, director of the U.S. Office of Bet Salem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, and co-director of Jewish Voice for Peace, where he currently serves on the board of directors. Mitchell Plitnick, welcome to Middle East in Focus. It's such an honor to have you on the show.
Great to be here.
Okay, so we have so much to talk about, so we're going to dive right in. Let's first start with sort of what Trump's policies looked like in his previous administration and what he claimed on the campaign trail. Now, in your piece, as I stated in my intro, you state that Trump's nominees reflect an extreme approach to foreign policy, especially in the Middle East, in terms of what we can expect this time around in a second Trump administration. So prior to his announcements, can you talk about what was his approach to foreign policy in the Middle East during his first administration and then while he was on the campaign trail this time around?
Yeah, I think in his first term, Trump, well, we know with everything, he was very transactional. But he had this sort of vision of being the president who brought some sort of agreement to Israel-Palestine, which was never realistic at all and never really serious. But that was the image he was trying to project. He appointed an ambassador who is as extreme as you can get, David Friedman, who is actually himself a settler. Or at least a funder of settlements, if we want to be very specific about it. So he also had his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, very deeply involved. But his broader foreign policy agenda, at least at the beginning, was one that he was trying to sell as professional. So he had people on his team who were either, generals or major businessmen, like, for example, his Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. Later on, his National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster was a general. Jim Mattis, his Defense Secretary, were people who were certainly on the right, even in terms of the military and in terms of business, but were respected in their fields. And they weren't necessarily people who you thought of as ideologues. They were people he was bringing in to sort of give a legitimacy to his own appearance as a serious foreign policy thinker. And his in his campaign this time, I think his he really didn't talk a lot about foreign policy in general. It certainly was not a priority either. You know, it wasn't a priority for him. It wasn't really a priority for Kamala Harris, except to the extent that activists went out and made it a priority and forced her to talk about it. She would have rather avoided it as well. But to the extent he did, Trump tried to, and I think in some sectors succeeded in sending the message that, look, you know, the Biden administration has increased America's participation in violence around the globe. It has presided over, and again, accurately, he would say, it presided over an extreme deterioration in the Middle East. And, you know, and his case was that in his term, that sort of thing didn't happen. Now, the reality is that much of what happened under Biden's watch was entirely set up by Trump's own foreign policies, especially in the Middle East. We can get further into that in terms of Iran, in terms of Israel, Palestine, all of that. But the reality is that a lot of the one of the biggest complaints that I think I and many others have made about Joe Biden's term is that he didn't break with Trump's policies. So a lot of the radical shifts that we saw in the United States, his approach to foreign policy in general, and certainly in the Middle East, were initiated by Trump, and Biden did nothing about them. But it does come back to Trump, but Trump has been able to take advantage of the fact that it really blew up on Biden's watch.
So, as you point out, even though on the campaign trail this time around, he tried to position himself as an anti-war candidate, if we actually look at the truth of the matter, what he did in his first administration actually was quite the opposite of that. As you pointed out, much of what we're seeing under Biden was actually initiated by Trump. And then in terms of what we can expect in this second administration for Trump, that also that illusion is being shattered, that he's somehow this anti-war candidate, especially considering some of his nominee picks. So let's dive into that a little bit. Can you first talk about Brian Hook, who's leading the State Department's transition team? Who is he, and why is he one of those people that sort of shatters this illusion that Trump is somehow an anti-war candidate?
Yeah, Brian Hook is an extreme Iran hawk. He was part of the State Department in Trump's first term. He was somebody who had a big hand in crafting the so-called maximum pressure policy against Iran. He was a critic of the Iran nuclear deal. He believes that concessions, quote unquote, to Iran, such as freeing up their own money, things of that nature, in exchange for anything, is the wrong way to go. He sees it as appeasement. He sees it as encouraging what he would call Iran's bad behavior. That would be the term he would use. So he is somebody who's very, very strong on sort of confronting Iran and not pursuing any sort of diplomatic resolutions with them. He also very much buys into the theory in the Middle East that you have sort of a sort of mini bipolar Cold War going on there between Israel and Iran. Israel on the one side, which would be our side, Iran being the evil nemesis on the other side, and that, you know, all the, you know, the vision there is that groups like Hamas, being Palestinian, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Ansar Allah in Yemen, all of these groups, and of course the various militias in Iraq and other places in Syria, these are all coordinated attack by Iran to assert its own dominance over the region in direct competition with Israel. This is how he sees the situation. One of the ways he also tried to exploit that or address that in Trump's first term was he was a big player in crafting the so-called Abraham Accords, which were the agreements that Israel struck with the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, abortively with Sudan, and with Morocco eventually. That completely bypassed the Palestinian question to normalize relations between those states and Israel. And that undermined undermine the last real card that Palestine has diplomatically in terms of Israel. The one thing that Palestine has been able to hold up and say, this is something Israel wants that they need us to deliver for them, is normalization with the Arab world. And it's been explicit since 2002 with the Saudi proposal for regional peace that included Israeli withdrawal and shared Jerusalem and recognition of the right of return with implementation to be negotiated. That was that in exchange for that, the entire Arab world would normalize relations with Israel. That was the basis for two decades of diplomacy in the Middle East, at least in the view of Palestinians and the sort of two-state camp. The hook worked to undermine that through the Abraham Accords, and I would argue that that was a key element in Hamas's decision to say, look, you know, if we don't do something dramatic to address the status of Palestine on the world stage, we're going to lose everything. And I think I believe that was one of the key factors in the decision to launch the attacks of October 7th.
So, okay, so now let's move into some of his other nominees with respect to U.S. Ambassador to Israel and U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. Can you tell us who they are and what is their background and what are their ideologies?
So the nominee for Ambassador to Israel is Mike Huckabee, who is an extreme Christian Zionist. He will not use the phrase West Bank, for example. He will only refer to Judea and Samaria. He believes that Israel is entitled by God to all of the land of what they call Greater Israel, and exactly what the borders of that are is unclear. There was recently an op-ed in the Jerusalem Post where a right-wing Israeli named Peter Freund argued that Greater Israel includes southern Lebanon. So, you know, these are very, very dangerous ideas. Huckabee believes that that this conflict that is escalating in Israel and Palestine is a herald of the rapture, that the return of Christ to earth and all of that. This is a key staple of Christian Zionism. It's something Huckabee believes in. And so Huckabee is an absolute supporter of Israel and will agree with whatever Israel's stances are. You know, the ambassador does not make policy. The ambassador's job is to carry out policy. And I suspect that Huckabee's role will very much be confined to carrying out policy, but he's still a spokesperson. He's still the person that is, you know, going to, you know, have a lot of quotes in the media, both in Israel, in the region, and here in the United States. So that's going to shape the way people see American policy and the way people see the whole conflict. He will broaden the message that this is God's will. And that message will resonate with some and it will anger others, but it will, what it will certainly do to almost everyone is turn up the volume on the anger and the rage that fuels fighting everywhere. Elise Stefanik is the nominee to be U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. So Stefanik has made a name for herself by leading the congressional hearings on so-called campus anti-Semitism, and has been one of the main figures in transforming the entire concept of anti-Semitism from actual attacks on Jewish people for being Jewish into meaning pretty much only criticism of Israel. But that is the only real definition that it has. People can see how this is playing out in the world by looking up Project Esther, which is the Heritage Foundation's new program to weaponize anti-Semitism against the Palestine Solidarity Movement. I have a write-up of it in Mondo Weiss Net. You can find it there. It's my latest article. She, in many ways, in terms of diplomacy at the UN, and certainly in terms of Israel's genocide in Gaza, is not going to change much from the Biden administration, from the current U.S. ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfield. She will continue to veto every Security Council resolution that in any way tries to end Israel's genocide or address Israel's criminal behavior. She will continue to defend Israel, and she will, you know, Thomas Greenfield herself has been a very vocal agitator for the idea that the United Nations is anti-Semitic. Stefanik will certainly be an even louder voice in those terms. But at least in that regard, I don't think we're seeing a big difference in that particular arena between between Biden and Trump 2.0. But what we will see is somebody who has already shown herself to be expert in warping the idea of the fight against anti-Semitism into one that defends against any criticism of Israel.
This is Middle East in Focus, and we are talking about Trump's most recent nominees and what U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East under a second Trump administration will look like with our guest, Mitchell Plitnick, a political analyst and writer, president of Rethinking Foreign Policy, and co-author with Mark Lamont Hill of Except for Palestine, The Limits of Progressive Politics. We definitely need a full hour, if not longer, to get into all of the nominees. So I'm not going to get into all of them. Unfortunately, we won't have time, whether that's Mike Waltz, Trump's pick for National Security Advisor, Mark Rubio, Trump's nominee for Secretary of State, or John Radcliffe, his nominee for Director of the CIA, all of whom also have very hawkish ideologies as it relates to their perspectives on U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. But I do want to get to, and then we'll get into specifically what it will look like in terms of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East under Trump. Can you talk to us about his pick for Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth?
Mm-hmm. So Hegseth is a Christian nationalist of the absolute worst kind. He is, as I described Mike Huckabee, as bad as that sounded, Hegseth is much worse. Hegseth is somebody who glorifies the Crusaders. He has a big tattoo of what's known as the Jerusalem cross on his body, which is not actually a religious symbol. It is a symbol of the Crusades. You know, so it's not religion. It's about conquest. Hegseth is somebody who believes in, and he's going to be, let's remember, Secretary of Defense. He is somebody who believes in using the U.S. military on U.S. soil. This is an idea he supports, and that is something that should alarm every activist on any issue, but certainly on the question of Palestinian rights, because we've already seen in the Biden administration how that his administration has reacted to activism on college campuses. What we're going to see with Hegseth, if he is confirmed, and he may not be because he is so radical, if he is confirmed, we definitely will see a real potential of military, National Guard, even the army being used against protesters on college campuses. And, if he has his way, I think what we saw back in the 60s with Kent State, the four students being killed by military personnel, will happen on a far greater scale. This is who he is. And he, again, as somebody who glorifies the Crusades, he very strongly backs the idea of military force to promote American interests in the Middle East and to promote Israel's goals in the region. He is an extremely dangerous individual who has no real concept of what he's doing. He doesn't have the background either for this job. His last job was as a Fox News host. This is not somebody who is, even on the most technocratic level, capable of running the Pentagon, but it will be in his hands. And so we're talking about an incompetent who will have that much power, literal military power in his hands. It is an extremely dangerous idea, and one that I don't, as much as some people have raised the alarm about Hegseth, including, incidentally, some Republicans have raised some quiet eyebrows about it. As much as there has been some alarm about it, I don't think it's been nearly enough.
So something that you speak about in your work is how, basically with Trump's nominees, that they've been, while they absolutely have and reflect this very extreme approach to foreign policy, especially in the Middle East, that they're mostly being brought in as loyalists and that they're really being brought in to support Trump's decisions this time around. And that, in fact, what you're anticipating is that Trump will be exercising much more control over U.S. foreign policy and really be looking to people outside the government to influence him in terms of policy making. So with that, what do you think U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East will look like under a second Trump administration? I know this is a big question, as it relates to, for example, Palestine, Lebanon, Yemen, and Iran.
So first, let me say, I think I do think that the people that he's put in are a reflection of what he intends to do rather than the people who will make policy, as you said. He will be listening to people he will be listening to people who he personally respects, and some, you know, we're now seeing some of them in being put into government. For example, Seb Gorka, who is a well-known white nationalist, has been affiliated with the neo-Nazi party in Hungary. He will be the deputy national security advisor. I believe that the idea of making him a deputy national security advisor is so that he can operate a little bit more in the background, but I do think he'll be more influential. Similarly, we all know Stephen Miller has been an architect of the xenophobic immigration policy. He's also a deputy. He's not actually running a department, and I think that's intentional. The people that Trump respects are usually fellow heads of state and people he knows personally and major donors. So I think he will listen to Benjamin Netanyahu to some extent, although I think he has had a somewhat turbulent relationship with Netanyahu, and I don't think Netanyahu will have quite the sway he might think he will over Trump, although he is very good at schmoozing and convincing people on that. And we know how susceptible Trump is to flattery. He will listen to people like Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. That is someone we know he respects. You know, many people will believe that he will listen to Vladimir Putin, and that is going to have, I think, increasing impact on Middle East policy. He'll listen to people like Miriam Adelson, who gave his campaign $100 million and wanted, although she didn't extract, at least publicly, an explicit promise that Trump would okay the annexation of the West Bank in exchange for that money. We know that's what she wants, and she didn't give him the money for no reason. So he'll listen to those kind of people. We know about Elon Musk, of course, and others like that. So that's the kind of advice he's going to get. And I think we need to look very carefully at that. What will it mean in terms of Palestine? I think very little will change. And I don't think Trump's going to try and take on changing Palestine. I think that we might see in the next few weeks a ceasefire in Lebanon. I think Netanyahu wants to do that for Trump. And I think we'll see it in December, maybe mid to late December, so that it can be portrayed as something that Trump, you know, that the ceasefire is happening so that it's not continuing. You know, Trump kind of caused it just by taking office. I think that will be, you know, the way that's presented. So in terms of the larger region, again, Trump may be more reluctant. It's possible that he may be more reluctant to actually commit U.S. troops to the region than Biden has been. But again, his selections for the cabinet post suggest that he is looking at that as a very serious option. I think he would rather intimidate Iran into the kinds of concessions that would be required to avoid that, and yet and still result in Israeli victory. But I don't think that's realistic. He may think that's realistic. So we're, you know, above all, it's very hard to predict exactly what Trump will do, because whatever Trump thinks today, he may not think tomorrow. He may not think in a month from now. He may think it, not think it, then go back. He's very mercurial, very moody. He makes decisions on a whim. He makes decisions based on who flatters him or where he sees his business interests. I think those are the things that will guide him. And unfortunately, they can change from day to day. So we're looking at, more than anything else, a chaotic policy that everybody is going to have to sort of deal with. And I think the Arab world and the Muslim world is seeing that too, which is why we've seen them line up behind Iran recently, which is very unusual, and express that they stand with Iran and against Israel's genocide and aggression. That those statements could come from the Arab League and Organization for Islamic Cooperation is a shift, and it shows that they're trying to prepare for what they know will be an unpredictable future.
This is Middle East in Focus, and we have been talking about Trump's most recent nominees and what U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East under a second Trump administration will look like with our guest, Mitchell Plitnik, a political analyst and writer, president of Rethinking Foreign Policy, and co-author with Mark Lamont Hill of Except for Palestine, The Limits of Progressive Politics. He also writes the Cutting Through newsletter at Substack and publishes a week